Luke chapter 10, again this morning, Luke chapter 10. Several months ago, Bud Rader contacted me about the potential of coming by here and giving a missionary report. He hadn't been back here since, I think, 2010, so it had been around 8 years that they were here last. And so we set up that schedule or that appointment for him to be here, and he was with us, as you know, last Sunday. And then sometime after that, Pastor Paul contacted me from India, saying that he had planned to be here in the States as well, and it would be possible for him to come by, and he had a particular date. And it turned out that the two dates were only separated by 2 weeks. And generally, we have one missionary speaker per quarter, if that many, per year. And usually, we don't have two missionary speakers butted up together that closely. But it just so happened, it worked out in the providence of God, that that's the only times that they could come. That's when it worked out in our schedule. So as you know, we're sort of designating October as a missionary emphasis month. We typically have not had missionary conferences, but we have a good number of missionary speakers. And so we have heard from a missionary last week. We'll hear from a missionary again next week. And it just so happens, within the providence of God, I'm sure purely by happenstance and a random good luck, we are in a mission text today. Well, of course, I don't believe in luck. I don't believe in random circumstances happening. I believe that God is sovereign. And within the providence of God, we are in Luke chapter 10, which is a description of Jesus sending out the 70. So without my planning it or working it out, it just so happened in the providence of God that we will have 3 Sundays in a row that speak to missionary endeavors. And in fact, I plan only to get through about half of this text today. So next week we'll have a missionary, and then the week after that, Lord willing, we'll have the second half of this passage. So that will be 4 missionary messages in a row in the month of October. So we definitely are having October as a missionary emphasis, and I think the Lord must want us to know something about missions or to be once again faced with the importance of missions if he has worked it out this way. Well, the first part of Luke chapter 10 shows us that Jesus sent out his 70 disciples to visit various communities as he traveled toward Jerusalem. As we read this passage, we find much that pertains specifically to these 70 disciples. Jesus chose these men specifically. He sent them out for a certain amount of time to specific cities with a specific ministry. He told them what to take and what not to take. He told them what to say and what not to say. He told them what to do if the people accepted his ministry and what to do if they didn't. The description is fairly straightforward. I think the language is fairly easy to understand. But the difficulty lies in knowing what part of this is specific to these 70 men at that place and time and what carries on with more timeless principles that we can apply to ourselves today. So is there an application of these principles? We find that there are many specifics here, but what about some general principles that we can apply to missions today? The circumstance is a little bit more complicated because in Luke chapter 22, Jesus sends out the disciples again, and he gives them a whole different set of directions. So I think that there are specifics here for that group of 70 disciples in that place and time. I don't think that we have a timeless set of rules here that we are obligated to follow. The specifics pertain to that place and time. They really don't pertain, as an obligation at least, to disciples today. However, within the specifics, I think we do find some timeless principles, things that come from this text and are further given to us or further reflected by other teaching in the Word of God as well. And so I want to focus on the principles, the timeless principles that come up from the text, the things that are underlying these specific principles are more general principles that we can apply to ourselves. We seek to follow the general pattern that we see here, even if we can't always follow the specifics. So as it is with oftentimes when we are reading the Bible, studying the Bible, there are specific things that pertain in that place and time, but underneath those specifics are general principles we seek to bring forward and to apply to ourselves. And so that's what we're doing today. We're looking at some general principles about missions that we can glean from this passage. And I think there are several, and hopefully we'll get through several of them today. First of all, in verse 1, Jesus selects and sends his disciples into ministry. Notice verse 1. After these things, the Lord appointed other 70 also and sent them 2 and 2 before his face into every city and place whither he himself would come. So he selects and sends. First of all, of course, he selects them. And we think typically that Jesus is followed by the 12 disciples, but here we have a group of 70 others besides the 12 that Jesus sends out. So very likely there's a large group of people, probably more than just the 12, more than these 70, but among all of those, perhaps 100 or more, that were following Jesus at this time, he selected 70 to go and to visit these places where he was planning to go. Now I think we would call this a temporary or a short-term missions trip. It seems like they go out briefly and they come back after not much time to give a report on what happened. And so this is not, I don't believe, an obligation that would be set in stone for all disciples after this to follow this pattern, but it is the pattern, the specific details of which Jesus gives to them that they are to follow on this short-term mission trip. And it says he appointed them. He appointed other 70 also. Now the word appointed is much like our word to commission. And we may say, well, we were not among the 70 who Jesus sent out, but we still are commissioned. We have the Great Commission. Go into all the world, preach the gospel, make disciples of all nations. So like these 70, we are commissioned. We are appointed. We are chosen, you might say, to go out and to confront our world. So he first selects, but then he also sends. And note the language here of sending. Verse 1, he sent them. Verse 2, he would send forth laborers. Verse 3, he says, go your way. And at the end of verse 3, he says, I send you forth. So clearly, Jesus has selected these men, and then now he's sending them out. He's pushing them out into the harvest field. The idea of Jesus sending out his disciples is very strong here. And of course, the idea is that they are sent to go to these other cities where Jesus himself was planning to visit and to serve. And this just makes sense. Even today, evangelists, if they're going to hold a evangelistic campaign, they usually send an advanced team ahead to prepare the place, to find a place to preach, find the venue, do some publicity and things like that. So this makes a lot of sense. But this account, I think, points forward to the universal mission of the church. Jesus selects and sends his disciples out into the world to reach others with the gospel. And that's us. If you are a disciple of Christ, you have been selected and you have been sent. We have the Great Commission. We know that God intends us to go out into the world and to preach the gospel. And so the pattern of selecting and sending workers into the harvest field is a timeless one that pertains to us today. All of us should see ourselves as selected and sent, just as much as these 70 were, just as much as the original 12 disciples were. In God's providence, he has selected us and he has sent us. He has compelled us to go out into the harvest field to try to reach souls for Christ. And so all of us should be participating. Jesus selected and sent those, and then he gave them a job. He gave them a duty, a task to do. And none of us should be just sitting on the sidelines, spectating, wondering what everybody's doing. All of us have a job to do. We all ought to be participating in this great work out in the harvest field. And so that means that we go on to verses 2 and 3, where we find that Jesus sees the world as a field ready to be harvested. He said unto them, the harvest truly is great, but the laborers are few. Pray ye therefore the Lord of the harvest that he would send forth laborers into his harvest. Now in those days, before the modern mechanical means of harvesting a crop, everything of course was done by hand. And if you had a crop out in the field that was ready to be harvested, you obviously needed laborers to get out there and bring in the harvest. Because if you didn't have enough laborers and the harvest was ripe and ready to pick or ready to harvest, it would just rot in the field and you would not have the benefit of all that labor that you put into those plants, those crops out in the field. So it was a real crisis if you had the crop ready to bring in and not enough harvesters, not enough workers to go out into the field and to get that harvest in. Well, there are two great principles here stated that certainly are timeless. He says, the harvest truly is great, but the laborers are few. The harvest, of course, is the number of the saved, the people who are going to be saved. The harvest, those who will be coming into the Lord's family, those who will be gathered in, those are the Lord's people, the Lord's sheep, those who are his, those whom the Father has given to Jesus. These will be those who are brought in. And it says the harvest is great. This word great often means something like many or much or large. So it's a large harvest. There are many people who need to be saved, many people who need to hear the gospel. And so the opportunities are great. The number to be saved is a large one. Great multitudes will be gathered in. And so Jesus sees this opportunity as a great harvest field that is ready to be gathered in. But in contrast to the great number of those who will be saved is the fewness or the smallness of those who are actually out in the harvest field bringing them in. This word few is often translated as little. There are only a few out in the harvest field trying to bring in the harvest, trying to bring in the crop. I think the general principle is that the evangelistic task is a large one, and too few of Jesus' disciples are out engaged in this task. For such a large task, there are only a few people working on it. And statistics prove that the vast majority of Christians never even try to lead a soul to Christ. I don't know if you can look back in your history and say, okay, at least I've tried to lead people to Christ. I've tried to have evangelistic communication with people. I've tried to give out tracts. I've tried to lead people to Christ. But you know, the truth is that many evangelicals, in fact, most of them, cannot even look back at one opportunity, one occasion, where they actually tried to engage somebody in an evangelistic conversation or tried to present the gospel or even handed out a tract. The vast majority are not engaged in, at least directly, in trying to lead a soul to Christ. Now, it's one thing if you've tried and nobody has responded. Okay, that's going to happen. Oftentimes when we try to present the gospel to people, they are antagonistic. They're hostile. They want nothing to do with it. And if somebody has slammed the door in your face or has pushed away the tract or has said, no thanks, I'm not interested in that, or has some way shut you down, well, that's okay. At least you've tried. But if you haven't tried at all, well, then the question remains, are you really even working in the field? Are you even a laborer? Are you even trying to do anything for the Lord out in his harvest field? Well, all of us should be involved in some way with reaching out into the harvest field. And there are different ways that we can do that. But everybody ought to be engaged. We all ought to understand our obligation to be busy serving the Lord in the great harvest. You know, the Bible says that God will say to those who have served him at the judgment seat of Christ, when we get to the gates of heaven or at some point, he'll say to those who have served him, well done, thou good and faithful servant. Well, he'll say that to those who have been serving him. You know, there will be those like, let's say, the thief on the cross, who get into heaven by the skin of their teeth, as it were. They are saved and they virtually do nothing for the Lord. There are those who are saved and for many years virtually do nothing. They don't do anything in service for the Lord. The Bible talks about at the judgment seat of Christ, all their works going up in flames, wood, hay, and stubble. They got nothing to show for their years of being a Christian because they never really did anything to serve the Lord. Others, the Bible says, will, for their service, they will have gold, silver, and precious stones. They will be laying up treasure in heaven because over those years, they served the Lord. They did something for the benefit of God in service to him. And so all of us need to ask ourselves that question. After the end of our life, is God going to be able to say to us, well done, thou good and faithful servant. Have you done anything to serve me? Have you been engaged out in the harvest field at all? Have you tried? Have you been busy in serving the Lord? That's the question that we need to ask. I trust that all of us want to hear that expression from the Lord, well done, thou good and faithful servant. You have served. You've been engaged in the great harvest field. I trust none of us want to see our works, the things that we supposedly have done for the Lord, just go up in flames because it really wasn't for the benefit of God. It really was not ultimately for the glory of God. I trust that all of us want to be involved in this great harvest field. So the harvest is great, the laborers are few, but then he says, pray ye therefore the Lord of the harvest that he would send forth laborers into his harvest. Notice that the Lord, he's the Lord of the harvest. God is the owner. This field that we're supposed to be working on, this vineyard is the Lord's. And we are to be out there working for him. This field is ready to be harvested and gathered in. But the Lord is in charge of the harvest. He's the owner. He's the one who thrusts forth laborers into the harvest. The problem is there are too few laborers. There's a great harvest and too few people And so the solution to this problem is prayer. He says, pray ye therefore the Lord, the owner of the harvest, that he would hire more workers to send them out into this great harvest field. Somebody said that prayer for preachers is Christ's method of increasing the supply. Prayer is the method of God increasing the supply. And so I wonder if you've been praying for those who are out in the harvest field, that they would be effective. And have you been praying for more laborers to enter the harvest field? We should be praying for ourselves that we would be effective servants out in the Lord's harvest field. We should be praying for others, that God would send others into the harvest field as well. And we should be willing that God would call those, perhaps even in our own families, into that harvest field. I know that sometimes as parents we are a little bit reluctant to let go of our children. We, as they grow up, we think, well, I sure hope they live with me or by me and we can enjoy the grandkids. But, you know, we dare not hinder the work of God. If God is calling our children into service, the last thing that we want to do is hinder them from serving him, even if it means going off to a foreign country somewhere, even if it means some sort of a sacrifice, even if it means we can't see our grandkids as much as we would like to. For them to serve the Lord is a great thing, and we ought to be praying. I trust that you are praying for your children and your family, that perhaps the Lord would use them. Maybe they won't be a foreign missionary, but in some way that your children and you and your entire family would be involved in this great harvest program, that all of us would have something to do in that work. Somebody said the Lord needs laborers, not loafers. And so all of us need, I think, to consider whether we are more on the laboring side or the loafing side. Let's make sure that we are laboring in the Lord's harvest and not loafing at home. Thirdly, we find here that in verse 3, he says, I send you forth as lambs among wolves. I think the idea here is that Jesus' disciples are vulnerable. Jesus has been talking about laborers going out into the field, but now he talks about the disciples as lambs among wolves. And so I think the idea here is that ministry, service for the Lord, can be at times risky. A lamb, of course, is a fairly powerless, helpless animal. It's not strong and forceful. It is often subject to more powerful and vicious animals like wolves. And like lambs, Jesus' followers may experience violent hostility against themselves. Just read about what's going on in China today, or in some of the Muslim lands. We really need to pray for our persecuted brethren. There are many, many hundreds, if not thousands of Christians, or at least professing Christians around the world, who are being persecuted right now. Their churches are being bulldozed, their leaders are being arrested, people are being killed for being followers of Jesus. And so we need to be aware that sometimes we are like lambs among the wolves, literally, where our enemies actually persecute and even kill some of us. Well, as we spread the message, we may find ourselves under attack, like lambs among the wolves. The unsaved will seek to chew us up and spit us out, as it were. They hate the biblical message, and they hate those who carry that message. Remember, Jesus said, if they hate me, they'll hate you. And so if we are true messengers of the Lord and delivering his message to others, we should not be surprised if we encounter similar kinds of violent hostility. Missionaries put themselves at risk when they go out into the harvest field. That's why sometimes families or parents don't want their children to go out into that harvest field, because it can be a risky thing. And some of you are well aware of that. Having family members in the ministry, you know that there are risks that they run because they're serving the Lord. Being a servant of the Lord is a great privilege, but it's also a great responsibility. It puts servants of the Lord at risk. But in spite of the dangers, the great shepherd of the sheep thrusts us out into the world to communicate his message. This is dangerous work, but we believe that there is the shepherd of the sheep who watches over us. We are like lambs among the wolves, but we believe the shepherd, the great shepherd, the good shepherd, is always with us. So those who are serving the Lord in his harvest field can't escape the risk involved. If you want to escape the risk, well, you simply won't participate in the great harvest. So we should expect to be mistreated by the wolves of the world. The world's hostility and antagonism should not prevent us from doing the job, though it should not stop us or hinder us from going out into the harvest field. Fourthly, we find here that Jesus' disciples walk by faith. Notice verse 4, carry neither purse nor scrip nor shoes, and salute no man by the way. So the first part of this, Jesus sends out the 70 without the normal means of support. He doesn't give them a bunch of money. He doesn't give them luggage. In fact, he says, don't even carry a purse. This would be a wallet or a money bag. He says, don't take a scrip. We don't even use that word today. It's the word knapsack or luggage, a traveler's bag. And don't even take an extra set of sandals, I think is what he means by don't take any shoes, nor shoes, probably an extra set of shoes. So don't take any money, no luggage, no food, no extra clothing. Now, how can you get along out in the world without these necessities? Well, the implication is that God would provide. Everything that you need, God will take care of. If the Lord of the harvest sends them out, then the Lord will also provide for their needs. And so I think another timeless principle here is that God provides the needs of those who walk by faith. Those who are obeying the voice of the Lord, going out into the harvest field, those who are serving God, God will provide their needs. Somebody said, it's not biblical exactly, but it's a good little saying, where God guides, God provides. And so we trust that God will provide for the needs of those who serve him. Now, how does that provision usually come to those who need it? It doesn't usually just drop out of the sky. The Lord doesn't just rain provisions out of the sky. He uses people like us back at home in local churches to provide the needs of the missionaries. And so we have to be responsible to do our part, to hold the reins, as it were, to take care of the needs of those who go out and serve the Lord full time. If we're not serving full time in the harvest field, then we support those who are going out full time into the work. Missionaries need people at home who can support them to go out and work in the harvest field. And so this is one way that we can be involved in the great harvest. Even if we can't be a full-time missionary, or even if we are not able to do other aspects of ministry, we can certainly support those who can. So whether we're working in the harvest field here at home or supporting missionaries who work in the harvest field elsewhere, we trust God to supply our needs. We walk by faith and trust that he will take care of us. And then fifthly, Jesus' disciples require a single-minded devotion to the task. We should not allow secondary issues to hinder us from fulfilling God's will and purpose. Notice it says at the second part of verse 4, he says, salute or greet no man by the way, and into whatsoever house you enter, first say peace to this house, and if the Son of Peace be there, your peace shall rest upon it. If not, it shall turn to you again. And in the same house remain, eating and drinking such things as they give you, for the laborer is worthy of his hire. Go not from house to house. And then he goes on to talk about what to do in these various circumstances. So I think the point that he's making is not to allow secondary issues to sidetrack or delay you from doing this great work. He says they're not to greet anyone as they travel. Now, there's certainly nothing wrong with greeting people as you travel, but the idea is that it could create a needless delay. They weren't to waste any time in idle conversation because they had an urgent mission to fulfill. Time was short. They had a lot of ground to cover, so they couldn't allow themselves to be sidetracked or delayed needlessly, and that would occur potentially if they stopped to talk to everybody along the way. Notice the language in verses 5 and 6, kind of an interesting thing here. Say peace to this house, and then if the Son of Peace be there, your peace shall rest upon it. If not, it shall turn to you again. So the basic idea here seems to be how the people receive you, my messengers, will say a lot about those people. The typical Jewish greeting when entering a house was something like peace to this house. You know the Hebrew word shalom. So when you entered a house, you would say something like shalom to this household or this group, this family. And as messengers of Jesus, the 70 were offering the peace of Jesus to that household. And if they received it, if a person of peace, a man of peace were there, if somebody who knew the Lord, somebody who was sensitive and open to Jesus, someone who maybe even believed in Jesus, if that person were there, then the peace of God would rest upon that house. And if that person were not a believer or who rejected the gospel, then they would not enjoy the peace of God. So the idea seems to be basically how they receive you as my messengers is an indication of what kind of people they are. He goes on in verse 7 to say, carry on in the house where you are staying without going from place to place. And the idea seems to be that they were not to try to find better accommodations or maybe better food somewhere else. When they're in the city, just stay put. The people who agree to host you, just enjoy their hospitality and don't try to go on trying to find a better place. The disciples in verse 8 were to eat whatever was given them or eat whatever the host was serving. Now back in those days, whom you ate with and what you ate were significant issues. There were traditions, there were biblical regulations regarding what you could eat and with whom you could eat. But on this missions trip, they weren't supposed to worry about that. They were to go to whatever host would agree to have them. And on this trip going to various cities, it might be that a Gentile would host them, or perhaps even somebody who is not quite as scrupulous as others in their application of the dietary laws. You're familiar with the idea of keeping kosher. Have you heard that before? Keeping kosher means that you have to follow certain regulations as you prepare your food. There are certain foods that you could eat and could not eat. And so many of the Jews, of course, followed the kosher regulations, but many, or some at least, did not. And you wouldn't expect that, especially in a Gentile household. So Jesus basically says, don't worry about the dietary food regulations. Just eat what's set before you without worrying about it. Whatever they give you, just eat that. And, you know, in many places, the missionaries have to do that very thing. They just, somebody invites them over for a meal, and you really don't necessarily want to know what's in the food that you've been given to eat. And then the idea, I think the other implication here is that you may have to associate with people that normally you wouldn't necessarily want to associate with. In serving the Lord, in preparing the way for Jesus, we sometimes have to eat food that we really would rather not. Sometimes we have to associate with people that we normally perhaps would not want to associate with. And there are times in the Christian ministry, times as you're reaching out to people with the gospel, that you might be associating with people that typically, or for how you feel about it, how I feel about it, we might not exactly enjoy associating with that kind of a person. I don't know if it's happened with you, but in my case, there have been many times when I've been in situations, been in people's homes, been with people that frankly I didn't feel very comfortable with. I remember the first couple of times when I went to the jail to have our jail ministry there, and it's a very intimidating thing standing in front of about a dozen people who you think could have been guilty of murder. I mean, these people look very intimidating, and some of them are all, you know, they look like a typical criminal, and you think, boy, if I say the wrong thing, this person's going to be grabbing me by my throat. Well, there are times when you have to submit yourself to the Lord and be ready to reach out to people that typically maybe you wouldn't have anything to do with, but the idea is you're trying to reach them with the gospel. And the gospel impels you, the gospel compels you to reach people and to sometimes associate with those who perhaps you wouldn't feel very comfortable with. But it's a gospel thing, and we're willing to do that. We're willing to be uncomfortable. You know, Jesus said the foxes have holes and the birds of the earth, or the birds of the heavens have nests, but I don't have a place to lay my head down. And that means that it's uncomfortable sometimes being a disciple. Following the Lord can be very uncomfortable. And we have to be willing to do that. We have to be willing to set aside our comforts in order to serve the Lord. That's what part of being a disciple is, that. So we have to be willing to set aside some of those things that we might not normally want to do. In verse 9, Jesus told his disciples to heal the sick and to preach the kingdom. Now, again, this is one of those particular things, I think, specific to those men. It would be wonderful if God commissioned us to go out and to heal all diseases. I really wish that I had that commission, that I could go into a community, go to the hospital, and just heal everybody. Wouldn't that be wonderful? But, of course, that was for this group of people at that time. They had that capacity to heal diseases. It talks about the fact that they exercised demons. So they had spiritual authority over sickness and over demons. And again, I think that was specific for them. We don't, frankly, have that capacity these days just to go and heal people. I know that some of our Pentecostal friends believe that they still have those powers, but I don't believe we do. I believe that that was certainly for these people. And as far as preaching the kingdom, saying that the kingdom had come near, Of course, Jesus was the king. He was about to arrive in that location. But of course, we also know that the Jews rejected Jesus as their king. And so as far as the earthly kingdom that the Jews were expecting, that would not be set up at that time because the Jews rejected Jesus. And of course, that was all according to God's plan anyway. We still await the earthly, physical, millennial kingdom of Christ that will, I believe, be set up when Jesus returns. But as far as preaching the kingdom, today we preach the gospel. The kingdom, of course, awaits the millennial reign of Christ when Jesus returns. So today we're really preaching the gospel rather than preaching the kingdom. Well, the overall point in this section is that disciples should not allow themselves to be hindered or distracted by side issues. Disciples must have a single-minded devotion to fulfilling the great task for which we have been selected and sent. Just like these 70 men, they were selected, sent, given a job to do, thrust out into that job, and don't let something delay you, don't let anything distract you. Now, we may not be distracted in the same way that the 70 might have been distracted here, but we probably have our own set of distractions that would hinder us from fulfilling the commission. Often we have to decide between good things and better things. We have to prioritize our obligations and put aside those things that would hinder us from serving the Lord. We may have to eliminate or reduce things in our lives that would hinder us from serving the Lord so that we could be more diligent. Disciples make serving Jesus their highest priority. So yeah, all of us have to look into our lives and see, here's what I would like to do, here's part of my schedule, but I may have to sacrifice this particular thing that I'd like to do, perhaps a good thing, because I am dedicated, I have a single-minded devotion to serving the Lord. And because of my devotion to serving the Lord, that means that I can't be involved, let's say, in something else. I would like to be, but this is hindering my service for the Lord. This is hindering my faithfulness to God. And so I have to eliminate it, or I have to change it, or I have to reschedule it, because I have a higher devotion to serving the Lord than I do to other things that may be good, but really are just a distraction that are preventing me from truly serving the Lord. So don't allow distractions to prevent you from serving God. We should be single-minded in our devotion to the Lord and His work. Well, as I said, I thought we'd get through about half of our text, and I think we've reached that point. I think we'll stop right here and pick it up again in 2 weeks. Thus far, we've seen that Jesus selects and sends His disciples out into ministry. We should consider ourselves selected and sent. If you're a believer, you are selected. If you're a believer, you are sent into the great harvest field. Jesus sees the world as a harvest field ready to be harvested. And so all of us should be involved in some way, manner, shape, or form in this task. Make sure that you are participating, not just spectating. We don't want to be sitting at home while others are out in the harvest. Jesus' disciples are vulnerable, like sheep among wolves. We should expect opposition and even hostility. If they treat you badly, that's the way they treated Jesus. If they hate you, they hated your master before you. Jesus' disciples walk by faith. We trust in God to meet our needs as we serve Him. So God's primary means of meeting the needs of others is through the generous support of those whom they serve. And then Jesus' disciples require a single-minded dedication to the task. We should not allow secondary things to hinder or delay our efforts to serve the Lord. As I was considering this message and this text, my mind went back to an old song that I'd heard years ago. It's called, "My House is Full, But My Field is Empty." I won't sing it, but I will give you the lyrics. "My house is full, but my field is empty. Who will go and work for me today? It seems my children all want to stay around my table, but no one wants to work in my field. Push away from the table. Look out through the window pane. Just beyond this house of plenty lies a field of golden grain, and it's ripened unto harvest, but the reapers, where are they? In the house. Hear the father sadly say, my house is full, but my field is empty." Well, let's pray.